And it is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman on this Wednesday afternoon. Today we focus on the business of entertainment, media, and sports with Harvard Business Professor Anita Elbersi. She's written Blockbusters, Hitmaking, Risk-Taking, and the Big Business of Entertainment. And the professor joins us from NPR, New York City. Welcome to you, Anita.
Thank you very much for having me.
The pronunciation, Elbersi?
That's pretty good. I say Elbersi, but Elbersi is pretty good.
Okay. We've had some discussion about it.
Well, Professor, it almost seems counterintuitive. Hi and welcome, by the way.
Thank you.
In this time of our digital wizardry, technological wizardry, when anybody can make a movie or sing a song or whatever, that the blockbuster would still be more successful and relevant than smaller, less expensive, more original, more independent content. Why do you think that is?
Exactly. I mean, I think you're hitting the nail on the head there, that it seems as if in today's world, where everyone can make a product relatively cheaply, everyone could record a song or make a video and upload those onto YouTube or other platforms. It seems that in that type of environment, the blockbuster would be under threat. But in fact, what we're seeing is that blockbusters are more popular than ever before. And with blockbusters, I mean the kinds of really big investments that some of the biggest media production houses are putting into the marketplace. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. One is obviously that consumers are really liking those kinds of products, and they go to the movie theater, and they go to the record store to buy those kinds of products. But I think there's also a supply side phenomenon going on. It's that the way in which these bets are being made makes it much more likely that they'll actually succeed in the marketplace.
You mentioned record stores, but just locally here, I mean, we've lost almost all of them. I mean, things have changed.
Yeah, absolutely. And digital technology is transforming the media industry. But I think the way in which people are making choices between all the products that are available to us, that hasn't really fundamentally changed. We still have a taste for the more popular products.
The effect of digital technology, I was wondering how it would have affected someone like a John Wayne or Marilyn Monroe in their careers.
Wow, that's a great question. I don't quite know how it would have affected their career. That's quite a long time ago. but what we're seeing, I think, when we're looking at the impact of digital technology on today's world, is I think two really interesting phenomena that I describe in my book. One is that some of today's biggest stars can go direct to the consumer. They can say, well, thank you to these big media companies that build my careers, but I can communicate directly with my fans now, and I can sometimes even sell products directly to fans. Obviously, that's harder for actors and actresses, but we see that in the music space, and we see that in the book space quite a bit, and even some television stars. And on the other hand, another trend we're seeing, which I think is also fascinating, is that we're seeing up-and-coming new artists that are coming up through online channels or establishing a fan base there, and then are signing lucrative contracts with the established media companies. And both of those are not necessarily good news for those established media companies, because they see their biggest stars leave, or at least they have the option to leave, but they also have to pay top dollar for those people that have used online channels to establish their fan
base. I suppose Justin Bieber would be someone who started on the internet and then went mainstream.
Exactly. That was one person I had in mind, and I describe his career trajectory briefly in the book. Another person there would be Amanda Hawking, a self-publisher. She was described by the New York Times as the darling of the self-publishing world. Sold millions of books all by herself, but then last year signed a $2 million contract with St. Martin's Press.
You focus on the enormously successful brand partnerships between stars and consumer good companies. So I'd like to start with looking at the publishing industry and Jay-Z's partnership with Microsoft. Tell us about that, and how did it work out?
So this is one of my favorite case studies that I describe in the book. And so what happened, Jay-Z had a book. He wrote a book in 2010, a lyrical memoir describing some of the ideas behind his rap lyrics. And he was looking for a good way to market this to the public. And he partnered with Droga5, which is an advertising company. They came up with this really fascinating idea to develop basically a really big scavenger hunt, where they would take the pages from the book and would hide them all over the U.S. So there were pages as huge billboards on here in Times Square in New York, a page wrapping a car in Brooklyn, a page stitched on the inside of a jacket, a Gucci jacket in a window store, and even a page at the bottom of the pool, of a pool in a Miami hotel. I don't know if you remember that one.
I think Camus did the same thing, right?
Sure.
So this is a really interesting campaign, and the goal was for his fans to find these pages using clues from social media, and then together piece together this book. The most interesting aspect of this campaign is that Microsoft paid for it, because when they realized that this was a great idea, but the publisher didn't necessarily have the money to pay for this campaign, they turned to Microsoft and said, do you want to team up with us? We could try to promote the book at the same time as we're trying to promote your search engine, Bing, and we'll get Jay-Z's fans to use the search engine and its map technology in the process of them playing this scavenger hunt. And I think it was definitely a huge success for Jay-Z. He sold, I think, over 300,000 copies of his book. And this was not a mainstream book by any means. And book by rappers in the past hadn't necessarily done so well. It was a huge success for Random House. They made their advance back and then some. And it was a moderate success for Microsoft. They saw the usage of Bing increase from 10 to 12% market share.
So that's why Microsoft did this. It was to promote Bing, so more people would now be using that as a search engine.
Exactly. That was their idea. They'd done some research and they realized that it's really hard to get people to use the surface once. But once they use it, their research told them that they're very likely to stay around because they'll discover that it's actually quite a good search engine. So what they wanted to do was to get them to try the service, and that was the goal of participating in this campaign.
It's pretty brilliant.
How about new wrinkles in sports personalities and marketing? Who are the top dogs?
Well, I think the top dog is in the Miami market at the moment. I would say that LeBron James is doing really interesting things in the area of sports marketing. As I describe in my book, he had a $90 million contract when he was entering the NBA, so that freed him up to make some really interesting choices. He didn't have to worry about his future at that time.
And who was that with? Who was that a $90 million contract with?
Oh, that was a contract with Nike. So this was a shoe sponsorship deal. And what he did is, at that moment, he established his own marketing agency led by Maverick Carter, one of his childhood friends, and a very, very smart prior Nike executive, actually. And he also started pursuing, or they together started pursuing, the kinds of deals that you normally don't see athletes of that caliber pursue. So what they did was they said, well, we don't necessarily want endorsement deals that give us a few million dollars up front. What we're really interested in are endorsement deals that give us a share of the revenues of the brands that we're endorsing, or maybe even an equity stake in the companies that we're partnering with. In a way, you could say that he was shooting for billions of dollars as opposed to just millions of dollars.
Was he the first one to do that? Michael Jordan didn't do that, or I'm trying to think of someone of his caliber.
Well, I think it had been done in the past, and Michael Jordan certainly has a very lucrative business with Nike at the moment with the Air Jordans. But that early in one's career, I think, is particularly rare. And one of the reasons why he did it so early in his career is because he had that very rich contract that gave him more freedom. But what I describe and what my research shows is that those kinds of partnerships are really the future of the sports business, where these these stars like LeBron James realize how much value they bring to the table and how consumers are responding to their involvement in brands, and they're saying, well, I want something back for that star power that I bring to the table.
How about in the NFL? Who has the most star power? Is it the Peyton Manning?
Well, when it comes to the NFL, I have to obviously speak out for our hometown hero, Tom Brady. I can't give props to Peyton Manning at that point. I do actually think that Tom Brady is slightly higher ranked in terms of his endorsement potential than Peyton Manning.
I was surprised to learn in your book that Maria Sharapova is the highest paid woman athlete in the world. She's certainly not the greatest female athlete, but you say she's the highest paid. What about Serena? Where does she compare to Serena Williams?
Well, Serena is close, but I think, Maria Sharapova is making more in terms of endorsement income. And I think that's a combination of obviously being extremely good looking and being very, very smart about building her brand. She entered onto the scene as a 17-year-old when she won Wimbledon, and at that time they were really, really careful in picking the right endorsements, and her manager, her agent, Max Eisenbutt, with whom I've had various discussions, was making sure that the first endorsement, the one that was going to define her, was a blue chip company, something that would really put her on the map. And they've gone from one great endorsement after another after that. This is really careful planning by Max Eisenbutt and her agency, IMG, to which he belongs. But also, I think Maria Sharapova and her unique talents as a model and as someone who's an extremely good spokesperson for the brands that she endorses.
Before we need to take a break in just a second, but before we do, would you tell that story of her first affiliation with Motorola, how that came about? It's such a brilliant marketing move.
Yes, absolutely. So she, when she won Wimbledon, one of the first things she wanted to do was call her mom. And so she had an unmarked, unbranded phone at the moment, and in front of millions of television viewers was desperately trying to reach her mom but couldn't get through. And one person at IMG saw that happening and immediately realized, okay, a cell phone endorsement would be really, really helpful. And we could link that to the story of being unable to reach her mom at that pivotal moment. Hmm. And that's how the Motorola partnership first came into play.
It's really something. We're speaking with Professor Anita Elbersi, and she's a writer, author of Blockbusters, Hitmaking, Risk-Taking, and the Big Business of Entertainment. Let's take that break, and we'll come right back.
And
Bonnie, maybe you could take over that role of the announcer at the American Airlines Arena.
I don't think so. So there we have LeBron. You know, one thing that just occurred, I'm just wondering if these superstars are so powerful, they can command any price, what does that mean for the profit margin for the very companies that are promoting them?
That's an excellent question. And this, I think, is one of the more fascinating aspects of today's entertainment business, because those profits are under threat precisely from those big investments in stars. It certainly ups the ante, right? It makes it very, very necessary that if you make these big bets that you do get the returns in the marketplace. So it increases the risk. But at the same time, not betting on these superstars is also problematic, because your competitors will, and they will see the positive benefits of doing so.
What about when they go off the cliff a la Tiger Woods?
Well, that's another risk, and every time humans are involved, we realize that humans can get into difficulties. And I think if you ask executives at Accenture, if they look back with fond memories on their endorsement with Tiger Woods, I think most of them will say, no, not really. But at the time, it certainly seemed like a really good strategy, and it brought the company a great amount of attention, and that, I think, translated into higher revenues. But yeah, those are the kinds of things that that make it really important to pick the right endorser, which I think is one of the reasons why people like Sharapova and LeBron James that have shown to be such great endorsers on a consistent basis will see their rewards increase.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Tell me, Anita, we've noticed changes in the publish industry doing this radio program. There's fewer book tours. There used to be escorts for every author, and the publishing industry is really backing off in promoting, except for the big name authors. Is that what you found?
Yes, you mean the ones that actually get onto Topical Currents?
Yes.
Those big name authors?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we don't have you live. We have you in New York City.
That's true. I would have flown in. I would have paid for it myself, actually.
I bet in December
if I'd known that was an option.
Right.
Exactly. The book publishing is experiencing, just like many other industries, is experiencing pressure from digital technology, the move to e-books, rise of Amazon, with its very, very thin margins, that is putting pressure, has basically put Borders out of business and is putting significant pressure on Barnes & Noble. Those are developments that are not necessarily in the best interest of the publishers. And they've been cutting back on the number of authors that they give high advances to. And they give bigger and bigger advances to the bigger authors. So we're seeing that blockbuster effect and the superstar effect in the book publishing industry as well. But there's certainly significant pressure on their budgets.
You know, something that occurred to me that I think is another irony, it seems that we're living in an otherwise austere time. I mean, the economy, the Great Recession. So why do you think it is that, or maybe you've already answered this, that in the areas of entertainment or now publishing, and it's really moving to other things, that there would be this blockbuster or tentpole, as you called it, strategy?
Yeah, as I said, it's really a combination of demand and supply factors, right? It's what the public wants, and you can turn it around. I mean, you could be very pessimistic about it and say, "Oh my God, the diversity is going down," and these are not necessarily very positive trends. And there certainly is I think room to worry. But you can also turn it around and saying, in these times in which it is increasingly hard to find an audience for these products, and there's an immense competition for people's attention, there are media executives that are willing to spend even more to produce what they think are the biggest products and the best products, even if they can't charge you more for it. Because in the movie industry, we pay the same ticket price, whether the movie costs $100 million or $300 million to make. So they're willing to take these risky bets because they believe that they need to give you the best special effects, or they need to give you the biggest stars, or they need to give you the most exhilarating scenes that will cost millions of dollars to produce. So I look at it in a positive light and say, even in this economy, there's an enormous amount of effort being exerted in producing really high quality products.
If you want to join in the conversation, the name of the book is Blockbusters: Hitmaking, Risk-Taking, and the Big Business of Entertainment. On today's Topical Currents, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or you can email radio@WLRN.org. Professor, going back to the story of Jeff Zucker from NBC Television on one side of the equation, Alan Horn from Warner Brothers on the other, tell us about that, because that's almost at the beginning of the time you're talking about.
Yes, exactly. So this is actually where the book starts. I compare Jeff Zucker, who at the time, and this is about a decade ago, was the head of NBC Television. At that time, NBC was the number one rated network in the U.S. And was going from strength to strength. And he got concerned about the amount of money that was being spent on their television shows. And he said, well, I think we should switch to a strategy of managing for margins, which essentially meant spending less on shows on average, and particularly trying to cut out these really, really expensive shows and opting for lesser-known stars and cheaper formats. And at that, around that same, and it seems a really sensible strategy, around that same time, It was Alan Horn at Warner Brothers who said, well, actually, I'm looking at the landscape as well, and I'm seeing that we should embrace risk and we should make even bigger bets. And he had this event film or tentpole or blockbuster strategy in which he said, I'm going to make three, four, five big films every year, and they might cost upwards of $200 million. But I think that's the way to compete in the marketplace. And if you look at those approaches, it seems that Alan Horn's, maybe for most people, it seems Alan Horn's approach is the riskiest and was doomed to fail. But in fact, he had tremendous success with that blockbuster strategy and went from strength to strength. He had 11 consecutive years of over $1 billion at the box office here in the U.S. and even bigger revenues abroad, whereas Jeff Zucker's strategy really backfired. And he brought the network down from number one to number four in ratings and also saw profit margins suffer quite a bit. Hmm. So that, to me, is the big tension that I address in the book, this notion that that making smaller bets seems safer, but it's actually a myth.
So where are they today, Jeff Zucker and Alan Horn?
So Jeff Zucker is heading up CNN. And it's interesting because I think this morning there was an announcement that he's planning to spend more on fewer shows. So maybe he's gotten the message from that that earlier experience at NBC.
Right.
And Alan Horn is currently in charge of Walt Disney Studios. So he's the person who greenlights movies for Disney. And within Disney there are also these satellite studios. So he oversees Marvel and Pixar and Lucasfilm. Many of today's biggest blockbusters are again made by Alan Horn.
How about pop music? Early on, Lady Gaga was a flop. How was she able to turn that around and become such a big-time star?
Yes, you're right that it took her quite some time to first get some traction, and that we often see. There are numerous stars, some of the biggest stars today, that once were dropped by their label or had a really rough start. And Lady Gaga was one of those stars who were dropped by her label. She then found a new producer and a new home, and found a great manager in Troy Carter. And I think they, as a team, started plotting a strategy to launch Lady Gaga. And I describe in the book how they conquered the market, one target demographic after another. They looked for sparks in the marketplace and said, okay, once we see, and actually Canada was a big market in which things went very well for her early on. When we see these kinds of sparks in the market, we're going to go all out and try to make her a success there, and then we'll build on that success in a subsequent market. So they launched her what I call a grassroots approach, and that turned out to be quite successful. And then once it started to catch on, it caught on in a big way, and she went from being the supporting act for New Kids on the Block in I think it was 2007 or 2008 to being one of the biggest stars on the planet in 2009.
Well, you talk about one of her albums, and we're going to get to that. But first, we need to take another break. We're speaking with Professor Anita Elbersey. She is the author of Blockbusters, Hitmaking, Risk-Taking, and the Big Business of Entertainment. We'll be right back.
It doesn't matter if you love him or capital H-I-M-M. Just put your paws up, 'cause you were born this way, baby. My mama told me when I was young, we're all on superstars.
Paul Leary is juking in the control room.
In a glass of purple dry. There's nothing wrong with loving who you are, she said, 'cause you made your perfect babe. So hold your head up, girl, and you'll go far. There's an American.
So there we have Born This Way, the single from Born This Way, the album. So it's not just her talent. So what is the reason for her enormous success?
She can sing very well.
She can. She is talented. And she's bright.
Oh, yes. She's a great singer, actually.
Mm-hmm. I saw her with the Rolling Stones doing Gimme Shelter. She was phenomenal.
Yes. No, and I think talent obviously is a necessary characteristic. It's really hard to make it as a singer if you can't sing. But she brings a lot more to the table. She is a phenomenal marketer. In fact, one of the executives at Universal Music, her record label that I talked to, said she could be the CMO of a big consumer goods company. And I think he's right. She has a really good understanding of what her brand is and how she needs to connect with her fans. Or how she can best engage her fans, I should say, and I think there was a, as I said, there was a very good strategy in place to launch her, and they realized what strategy was most appropriate at what time. So for her first album, this grassroots approach certainly was, in many ways the only option because there wasn't a whole lot of money, but also was the best way to carefully build her brand over time. But once that massive audience was there, for Born This Way, the third album, they went all out with a blockbuster launch. They had the biggest launch of the year and actually used an array of different brand partners to make sure that everyone knew that this album was out and that they had plenty of opportunities to purchase it.
So is she today's Madonna?
Yeah, I was wondering how she compares to Madonna.
Well, I'd say that today's Madonna is Madonna. and today's Lady Gaga is Lady Gaga. I wouldn't necessarily compare them as much as most people have done. I think they're actually quite different in the way in which they have risen to stardom and how they approach their art. And I would say that they each deserve their own place in pop music history.
What about the artist, the creative person without any business acumen? What will they need to do in order to succeed in the current landscape?
An executive without any business acumen?
No, an artist.
Or any artist without any business acumen.
Right, a creative person, because many creative people are without that.
Yeah, well, I think it's probably not wise to try to make it into an industry if you have no idea about the underlying economics. So a first and very obvious suggestion would be to actually buy my book. I think it's only $30. It's $18 on Amazon. This is a small investment to make if you're going to be investing a lot of time in trying to
make
it as
an artist. Oh, a little
plug-ola, huh? Exactly. I'm a marketing professor, so I have to do these kinds of things. But beyond that, I think more generally, it does make a huge difference if you have an idea of how this industry works. And I would always suggest that anyone who's trying to make it in the world of music, or is trying to become a successful author, or who's trying to make it as an actor or as an actress, is not just look at it from your perspective, but also look at it from the perspective of those who are making investments in you. And try to understand where they are coming from and how they will try to make those decisions and how they eventually will judge you. And if you sign with a major label, you know that you probably have one shot to make it. If you sign with a much smaller label, they will invest more money and more time in trying to get you to be in a breakthrough place. But their chances of making it might actually be smaller. So mm-hmm. You want to have a good understanding of the marketplace before you enter.
Our number 1-800-743-9576. If you'd like to join in the conversation, 1-800-743-WLRN. Email radio@WLRN.org. We'll take a first caller, Chris. He's in Hollywood. Hi there.
Yeah, hi. I just heard the author's comment regarding understanding the marketplace. What about someone like Van Gogh? And I just want to add one other comment about sports marketing. When you wrote your book, were you aware of the Lance Armstrong controversy? And that controversy went back to 1999, and knowledgeable people, especially like Nike, they knew that Armstrong was a fraud back then, and I just like your comments on that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Anita?
Thank you. Van Gogh, the painter?
Yes.
The Dutch painter, from my home country.
One of your brethren.
You are Dutch, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm uniquely qualified to talk about
him. And how do you
well,
actually pronounce Van Gogh?
Yes, Van Gogh is what
Van
we would
Gogh.
Say. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. The ch is a terrible sound for everyone who's not from the Netherlands. But he's one of the superstars, obviously, in his particular domain. But I don't think at the time that he was alive, he was that big of a superstar. I think most of the money on his paintings was made well after his death.
Oh, yes.
If I'm not mistaken. So I'm afraid that he didn't quite get to enjoy the riches that come with being a superstar the way that LeBron James and Lady Gaga have had a chance to. But obviously, there's these types of superstars in many different domains. And to the question of Lance Armstrong, I think the fact that there were problems in the world of cycling, I think, was known for quite some time. But I'm not sure if anyone without direct knowledge was quite as informed about how deep the problems were. And I for one, was quite shocked when the report started coming out on Lance Armstrong. And this is one of those situations. We talked about the Tiger Woods situation where companies and individuals have made enormous investments in an individual, and then to see something like this happen, I think is just extremely unfortunate for everyone involved, particularly when you're talking about charities that are trying to do good in the world that are seeing big hits in a negative sense, that are seeing a very strong negative effect as a result of these kinds of circumstances.
We're talking about entertainment, blockbuster entertainment, with Anita Alberce. How about nighttime club rows that really make it big? I'm thinking of course, South Beach and Miami's downtown club scene. What makes them so popular and so big?
Yes, this is one of my favorite subject areas. I keep joking with my students that I get to party and call it research, which makes them very jealous.
We're only three blocks from Miami's downtown scene, so you should have flown down. You should have flown down.
Yes, exactly. This is starting to look more and more appealing. I should really drop by. But Miami, all kidding aside, is one of the U.S.'s biggest markets for nightlife, and actually quite impressive. There are some companies that I think are really fascinating examples, and some that have shown to be really, really smart about the business. The company I've studied is a company called Tao Group, or Strategic Group, which is a subsidiary, and they have nightclubs in New York and Las Vegas, and then now one in Sydney. And what has been really interesting, I've actually studied them at different moments in the past 5 or 6 years, and their model has really evolved. It used to nightlife used to be all about buying yourself into the club by buying a seat at a table, which really means buying bottles that you're going to be consuming throughout the night. And these bottles are could be upwards of $500, right? So you might easily spend $1,500 for a night, which may sound ridiculous to many of us, but those are the kinds of amounts that are being paid. And this was all about hanging out with really good-looking people and trying to rub elbows with the jet set.
Bonnie and Paul were there last night.
Oh,
yes, I can imagine. But the world of nightlife has evolved, and as I point out in the book, has become much more like other sectors of the entertainment. And the world of nightlife is by no means alone, but I think is a really good example where there are now superstars in the world of nightlife that we haven't seen before, which are the DJs, and they can make up to $400,000 a night to play in a given night. Yes, these are insane amounts of money. Yes, absolutely.
So who are we talking about? Like whom?
So we're talking actually quite a few Dutch DJs. there's Tiesto and Armin van Buuren. There's Afrojack, which is a very famous DJ. Those are the types of Cascade is an American DJ, which is very famous and quoted in the book. So these are people that can make an enormous amount of money. And what we see and what the club that I studied did is that increasingly these impresarios are catering their clubs to these big DJs. So they make sure that the DJ booth is in a central location and that they have all the right conditions to play.
This makes Studio 54 look like kindergarten.
Exactly. Yes, that's an entirely different model, and so we're seeing a strong evolution in this market. And the other thing that we're seeing is, in order to pay for these big superstars, we need scale. Just like we have bigger and bigger Hollywood studios and bigger budgets, we're also seeing bigger nightlife venues. So the latest addition here in the U.S. is a club in Vegas called Hakkasan, which is a $100 million club. So they need these big investments in order to afford these big stars, and that is necessary in order to attract audiences. So it's very much looking like those entertainment markets that we've discussed earlier.
David in North Miami Beach, I don't even understand the question. I hope you do. He asks how you would compare unlikely rivals like the current Thor movie with the cinecast of The Day of the Doctor on November 23rd. Do you understand that?
I have no idea what that question means.
Neither do I.
Okay, I think Paul does. I think it has to do with Doctor Who. Is that it? Yes.
I think I might have to brush up on my
okay,
Doctor
it was
Who
a world,
and my comic book characters.
David, Paul just told us it was a worldwide simulcast of Doctor Who on November 23rd. So I guess David in North Miami Beach, we can't answer your question.
Boy, I'm sorry I missed that.
All right, well... Well, speaking with Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School, Anita L. Bursey, about her book, Blockbusters, Hit-Making, Risk-Taking in the Big Business of Entertainment. One more short break, and we'll be back.
And it's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Professor Anita L. Bursey. She's written Blockbusters, Hit-Making, Risk-Taking, and the Big Business of Entertainment. In our last segment, if you'd like to join in, it's 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN or email to Bonnie at radio@WLRN.org. Let's see, we have Dizzy. Dizzy in Miami?
Hello?
Hi, Dizzy.
Hi, how are you? I had a question for Anita. I'm a singer-songwriter here in Miami, and my band and I are starting to get work, but in a tough market like Miami where we don't play Latin music or rap or reggaeton or anything like that, what advice would you have in order for a pop act, a pop rock act in Miami to break out or to be successful locally?
Any ideas?
Maybe go to Orlando?
Maybe read the book.
It's not possible right now.
I'm sure read the book is part of the prescription.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. I would say that would be a suggestion number one. Another suggestion would actually be, which I think applies across a wide range of entertainment businesses, is to look for other bands that or other singer-songwriters that are like you. And I know you mentioned that there aren't that many. But you only need one or two, and if they are slightly more successful, there's a whole lot you can learn from them, right? So this is advice, for instance, I give a lot to people who say, well, it's so hard to break into the book market. I have a book, I can't get an agent because the agent say, well, I'm only going to look at your book even if you show me that you have an interest in this, that there's some interest from a publisher, and you're not going to get interest from a publisher unless you have an agent. So to break through this chicken and egg problem, I often say, well, what you want to do is look at someone who's like you and then find out who they worked with.
So this is your first book, Anita. How did you get it to be published?
Well, and not just published. We're talking about a blockbuster, aren't we, with this
yes,
particular book?
Yes, we are.
This is really interesting because as I was writing about the entertainment business and trying to break into the book publishing business, I was actually experiencing it at the same time. But, I mean, I have the huge advantage that Harvard is a brand that many
right.
people know. So I think that makes it a little bit easier. But even then, I think I looked at people like me who had been professors at the business school and had written a similar book, and not necessarily a book about the same topic area, but something that would appeal to an audience that cuts across those who are in the business or those who want to be in the business or those who just want to understand a particular business, right? So this is a book that is for everyone who's interested in pop culture. So I looked at examples like that for other sectors and said, okay, how did they do it? How did they reach these markets? Who are the agents that they worked with? Who are the publishers that they talked to? And anyone who's already been through that process once will be a better candidate to work with you going forward because they know how they did it and what worked and what didn't.
Who's
so
the best?
That, I think, would
who's
be
the best example, though?
The best example of someone who did
that
what
you,
I'm trying
that
to
you
do.
That you patterned your publishing efforts.
Well, so I'm a big admirer of Clayton Christensen, who is one of the world's leading management thinkers and happens to have his office just a few doors down from mine. And so that's a huge advantage. He's actually, he's also quoted on the back of my book because it turns out he likes my book quite a bit. But what he has done with The Innovator's Dilemma, which is still a book that is being sold now, even though it was first released years and years ago. I think that is just phenomenal. It's a truly remarkable success story.
We just have an addendum here back to David's email. It turns out, Paul Leary tells us, that this Day of the Doctor that was simulcast on November 23rd was simulcast in 94 countries across the world.
Yes, I must have missed it entirely. I've been very busy on the book tour. I really apologize. I have no idea what was going on at the time. I'm not really a big fan of the genre.
Yes. Let's take a call or two. Renee, she's in Miami Lakes. Hi there.
Hi, guys. Actually, it's the heat. Really quick question for the professor regarding how or what techniques or what she can recommend for those small businesses that have been around for a while, are struggling to get to that next level in being able to promote themselves or to be recognized. What has she seen based on her studies that one can do?
Is your business of the entertainment net a venture?
No. It's more in the health, skincare, cosmetics type world.
Okay.
Right, which is also actually relatively heavy on blockbusters. So one example that comes to mind, which I describe in the book, is a very small label in New York called Octone Records. And what made them stand out from the pack is that they formed a partnership with a larger major label, at first with Sony, and now they're with Universal. And that gave them the ability to do what they're good at, which is work with artists and make sure that they find a sound and find an audience, but then also they can go to Universal, and as I describe, it's been very, very successful. They can go to Universal and say, okay, this is an artist that's on the verge of breaking through. Now we need your help. We need your distribution power. We need your marketing power, and that's one of the reasons, for instance, why Maroon 5 is as big as they are today. They were launched with that particular strategy in mind, and it's been tremendously successful.
Okay, so merging with a big boy.
Not necessarily merging, but finding a way to partner.
To partner, okay. Interesting. All right, well, thank you very much.
Okay,
pleasure.
Let us know how it works out.
Thank you, Joseph.
Okay.
Professor, tell us about Burberry, because that's a kind of fascinating thing, what they're doing.
Yes, absolutely. So I had an interview with Angela Ahrendts, the outgoing CEO of Burberry. And I asked her to describe the company, and I was prepared for her to say, well, we make trench coats, or, well, we're a fashion business. And what she said blew me away. She said, we're a digital media company. That whole notion that she looks at her company not as a fashion company or not as a manufacturer of fashion items, but as a company that's in the storytelling business, that's trying to connect with consumers, that's trying to produce content. They have hundreds of people who aren't really making fashion items. They are making fashion shows, or they're producing websites. They're producing content that is designed to engage audiences and make sure that they tell the kinds of stories that best tell the Burberry story, that best represent what the brand is all about. That, I think, is really interesting. And they're using new technology to push that even further than anyone else, I think, has done in the past, especially anyone in the fashion space. And that has been a really, really successful strategy for Burberry. They've seen their revenues, I think, increase threefold in the past few years under her leadership.
So the messages in your book, blockbusters, I guess they could be applied to maybe any business right now. I mean, it looks like this is the strategy that is successful.
Well, I'm not sure if it's any business, but it's certainly a wide range,
right,
of different businesses. In the book, I give examples for beverages. Red Bull, I think, is an example of a company that fits this strategy very well. I give an example for Apple, which, in my perspective, has been running on a blockbuster strategy for quite some time now. I give the example of the hospitality business, the nightlife business that we've discussed. I give the example of Victoria's Secret, which with its Victoria's Secret fashion show and its angels is betting on blockbusters and betting on superstars too. So yeah, I think it can be applied to a wide range of industries, and the kinds of insights that I've learned for the world of entertainment are the kinds of insights that managers across a wide range of different sectors I think can benefit from.
Well, we want to thank you, Professor Anita L. Bursey. She's a writer, author, and professor of business administration at Harvard Business School.
We'll also have links to the book at the Topical Currents Facebook page, as well as our website, WLRN.org.
And do you have your own website outside of the school?
Yes, it's just my full name, so AnitaLBursey.com.
Okay.
And there's also blockbusters-thebook.com.
All right, let me write that down. We'll have all those links on our blockbusters-thebook.com?
Yes, that's it.
Okay, and the name of the book is Blockbusters, Hit-Making, Risk-Taking, and the Big Business of Entertainment. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a blast. Thank you.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on here. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives. Technical direction by assistant online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like if you will. Tomorrow's program begins with the superintendent of Biscayne National Park. There are public meetings scheduled about its future, including the option of loosening public fishing regulations. Also, Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining. It's the Gadget Show. So, to today's calendar on this day in 1937, 76 years ago, the birth of Max Baer Jr. in Oakland. Of course, he played the dolt Jethro Bodine on the Beverly Hillbillies. The ultimate victim of typecasting, Baer actually had some good book learning. He minored in philosophy at Santa Clara University. He once dated actress Sharon Tate. And on this day in 1993, 20 years ago, the death of unclassifiable musician Frank Zappa of prostate cancer. He was of Greek Arab descent. Get this, NPR's late Daniel Shore eulogized at his funeral. One more while we pick and roll. On this day in 1997, 16 years ago, the NBA's Latrell Sprewell is suspended for choking and threatening to kill his coach, PJ Carlesimo. He later starred for the Knicks. So we leave with a thought from Zappa, who testified before Congress in 1985, deriding Tipper Gore's censorship movement. Quote, "There are more love songs than anything else. If songs could make you do something, we'd all love another. One another." Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening.